Begin by asking when you came to Alaska.
I came to Alaska the first time in about September of 1960 on a belated honeymoon trip with Omar Stratman. And we traveled over through the mainland and was at the state fair, saw those huge cabbages and thought that that's the way all gardens grew in Alaska. To find out later that I couldn't do that. And let's see, he flew on out on the Aleutian chain then because he was looking at that for ranching. And I met him here on Kodiak Island then, so that was in 60. And then we went back to school for 2 years. Finished up getting my teaching degree. And then we came back out on the Aleutian chain at Akutan for our first teaching assignment.
Oh, was he a teacher too?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was the head teacher and I was the subordinate teacher. Where I had the first 4 grades and he had the upper 4. Excuse me. Somewhere I have written the letters that I wrote at Akutan, which would be an easy thing for you to refer to because it was so exciting, so new. And like details of my experience with my first king crab and things like that.
How far out is on a chain is that?
It's the third island, this side of Dutch Harbor.
Oh.
It was pretty beautiful little place, very perfect. They didn't like, we were employed by the state. It was a state-operated school, and they didn't send new teachers into difficult situations, usually. So, as I've learned about other teaching possibilities, that we were in a very sheltered, very, very ideal situation.
It was native children?
Mm-hmm, all native. I had come out of the hay fields where I'd worked all summer. My hair was bleached just almost white and so blonde, and my skin was very tan and blue eyes, and everyone I saw was dark, even my husband. And I just sometimes absolutely look at myself in shock as I'd see my image in the mirror or something, because I didn't fit at all. And in science class, whenever we'd have just free questions, little Dimitri would hold his hand up. How come you have yellow hair and blue eyes? And then I'd go into all my explanation about my heritage and everything. It was pretty remote. We went 6 weeks one time without any mail.
That's a long time.
There were no flights or anything into the village, and so to get there it was charters from Cold Bay over in a goose. And so whenever there was a charter coming, they would put the mail on for Cold Bay. But otherwise, there was a mail boat that went up and down the chain at that time. It was the expansion, and it carried mail out the chain and back.
So how long would it take a letter to get from there, say, to?
I don't remember. I don't know. I think they probably went to Cold Bay and then were picked up by air, or they could drop the mail once they got to Dutch Harbor on Alaska, and there were flights there. So probably they picked up the mail, both coming and going from those places. But if the weather was bad or the boat had difficulties, then we didn't get mail for periods of time. But other than that, it was pretty nice.
Were you the only non-natives in this, or was there more people in the village?
It was mostly, let's see, there were some part natives, and there was one other guy part of the time that was full Caucasian. And during the winter time, at that time, Akutan didn't have any fish processing plants or anything, which now they do have. So in the winter time, the men would go out to Adak work on the deep sea, which was a processing boat out there. So through many of the months in the wintertime, it would just be my husband and old men in the village, and women and children. But we only stayed 1 year.
Just a year.
That was, they really wanted us to stay. And the chief, William Cherpanoff, was also our janitor, which I thought was kind of a conflict in roles, but he just pleaded with us to come back another year. But we were really interested in looking into ranching, and that was one reason we'd gone out there to begin with, was to get a feel for what it was like out there. And I'm glad we did that, because it was so remote. Yeah, and marketing problems were such a problem also. If we think we have a bed on Kodiak, you know, I think how much better off than being out there. We had looked at buying one of the ranches here on Kodiak when we came in 60, and so when we left Akutan, we came here and purchased Dave Henley's ranch at Calson Bay, went back to summer school, and we were hoping to teach in Kodiak, but we couldn't both get teaching assignments, so we went to Soldotna that year to teach. And in January, we were having troubles with the hired man that we had hired to look after the ranch, and so Omar quit school and came over here, and he was here then when the earthquake and tidal wave hit, and I was at Soldotna. And we didn't have any communication for about 10 days, and I didn't know whether I had a husband or not. And there were 6 people killed on the ranch and on the road going through there. That's quite a story in itself. But we did lose our personal losses. Was a bunch of Pyrgood Scotch Highland cattle that we had shipped up from Colorado. They were mostly down in the tide flats, and all of the heifers were killed. I think at that time we estimated that it was about a $15,000 loss in cattle that we lost. But we're fortunate that no lives, you know, to us at least. There were 6 on the road way there. My husband was very involved with that too.
Did you feel any of the earthquake in Soldotna?
Yeah.
It was felt wide then.
Yes, it was. I was in the basement of a motel. I was taking care of a motel. I think it was the Y Motel. It was a log motel for a German couple that had gone on vacation, and business hadn't been very, very heavy, so they thought they could leave it to a school teacher to attend in the evenings. And so I just would lock it up during the days, and in the evenings have it open. And they told me that I could have 50% of whatever I took in. Well, I was busy, and they didn't quite think that was fair when they came back. But I was there. I was doing laundry in the basement, and the lights went out, and the building started swaying, and I got outside. And being a log structure, the whole building was just giving, swaying with every wave. And remember the big trees out in the back of the parking lot were just like bending in half, like about 40-foot trees. They just bend in half one way and then whip back the other way, just like they were rubber. Can't imagine that trees could bend like that and not just break right off. And the cars that were in the parking lot in front of the post office, a lot or so away, were bouncing literally off the ground. You could see the ground just like it was water. You could see the waves. You could literally see it come, the waves coming. It was so bad you could hardly stand up. The snow was real deep. I remember falling down several times in the snow.
What an experience.
Yeah.
took your flow. So that, let's see. Then when school was out, I came over to the ranch then, and Kodiak had so much devastation. I had only seen pictures and so forth, and descriptions given to me of what it damaged. Then I remember old Kodiak, though. It was such a jumble downtown, little winding streets and little bars here and there and everything, and I thought I'd never drive in Kodiak. So there were some good things came out of the terrible chaos that the tidal wave did, because urban renewal came in then and reconstructed all the downtown area and laid out nice streets, and the island had sunk about 6 feet with the earthquake, so much of what was the former downtown area was underwater at high tide. So they had to start hauling and fill. Most of your downtown city area is on fill. You just raise that up again. And so I was here then through all of that. As to get to the ranch, the tidal wave had taken out all the bridges on all of the streams. And of course at high tide, the tide was over the road in a lot of places. So people would travel from Chiniac to town in kind of caravans at low tide. And the missile tracking site was open out there then, so there was quite a bit of traffic. A lot of the guys went to motorcycles and just, because they could go to higher trails and get around much of it. But we had some real harrowing tales of getting to and from the ranch to town. We didn't do it often. But that summer, let's get this right. We had gone back to summer school after school was out. That's right. And we had adopted Vicky, our first child then. So we got her in about, so she was born July 3rd, and we got her when she was 2 weeks old. So it was in late July when we came back with her. And of course, everything was still all torn up. And she was only 5.5 pounds. My brother said he took one look at her. He was at the ranch working for us and thought she'd never make it. how far we were away from town and everything. But for a 6 weeks checkup when we came to town, we had to ford streams and everything. It was really quite a deal. Let's see, where were we?
We were at, you just brought the baby home.
Oh, okay.
And you went for your 6 week appointment.
Yeah.
That's right.
She rode on a road grader and she forded a stream. And I learned the road grader had that black, greasy hands. So I'm carrying this baby in this bright pink blanket. And he puts his hand on the front and says, "What is he?" And then we had to, we got into a state vehicle and they pulled us with a D8 cat through the stream over to the other side, and we got in our vehicle and went on to town. When we came home, they had laid flat cars, rail flat cars across the streams without any decking on them. And they have two rails going this way that are just right for, maybe they put planks on, I'm not sure. Anyway, there were just these two things you could drive on that were just the width of your tire. But as you drive, you can't really see what you're doing. So my husband's driving and I'm hanging with a flashlight out the window, shining it in front of the tire as he crept, and I'd say, "Left, right," as we drove across this plank.
You would have known if you didn't make it.
I wonder how we knew they were safe. Must have been metal. I don't know.
Must have been younger than it, didn't care. Must have known it was good. Oh.
That was my first summer in Alaska too, and it was just neat with the daylight, long daylight. And tried my garden to grow those big cabbages, and I just had such total failure. It was just sad. That's learned a few tricks. Let's see. So then I taught school that fall here in Kodiak. Let's see. He didn't take a teaching assignment. He stayed at the ranch, and I taught third grade for the next 2 years.
Now, would you drive back and forth?
No, it was just such an undertaking to get over the road system that I stayed with some members of the church the first while, and she babysat Vicki for me. And housing, people were just doubled up all over town. And all of the Aleutian homes were part of the Alaska housing at that time. And so they'd come around and check on how many families were living, doubled up, and tell you that you couldn't do it, but you had no options. And a fifth or sixth grade teacher, single teacher, and I finally managed to rent a little house together. And so, I don't know, after about 2 or 3 months, we were able to do that. And then I would go to the ranch weekends, if I could. I didn't every weekend, but usually I'd go out to the ranch. And it was a different world. It was really kind of fun, though. We got to know people that travel the road, because you do it in groups, and some of my long-lasting friends are ones that are people that I met during that time. Just Dave Gingrich out at Chiniot now is a good friend, and that's how we met, was during helping people across streams and everything during those days. So after my second year teaching third grade, we adopted Craig. We got him in Colorado also. We got both of Vicki and Craig through Colorado Welfare. And so I didn't want to teach full time anymore. And so I started the Teensy Bear Preschool then. That was their first year, and they hired me as a teacher. And
what year was that?
That was in 66. And so I would get up early and go out and prepare for that and leave the kids at babysitters. I'd sometimes take Vicki with me, but she was only two and a half, and really young. And so I did the preschool that year, and then the next 2 years I stayed at the ranch, and it wasn't like I was on vacation. I remember feeding the cattle and everything. Sometimes we'd have a hard night. And at this point, Omar had started back teaching too. He was teaching and I wasn't. And I did feeding and everything with the kids. I just load them in and head out.
Now, was the cattle for a business or for personal use?
It was a full beef cattle ranch.
Was it very prosperous?
Always had been a struggle, and we finally got up to about 800 head of cattle. And this building right down here, this big green building, you come around, this slaughterhouse, it's a rancher's co-op facility, and we were in on the building of that. And use that, and I would work in the slaughterhouse. I've done everything but kill the animals in there. Some things some people would think weren't very ladylike. We had to do it. And learned, you know, all aspects of the ranching thing, and I worked out right with the men, and fencing and working the cattle and branding.
Well, do you have trouble with bears, with the cattle?
Yeah, a lot. Some years were worse than others, and the ranchers would, we didn't have telephones then, I don't know, I guess we'd just run over to the neighbors, which the ranches are pretty far apart. that they would organize hunts when they knew that there was a bear making kills on one of the ranches. Sometimes they were successful in getting the bear and sometimes not. Joe Zentner was our neighbor over at Passaic Shack, the Passaic Shack fishing area and all that was his homestead. And he had had a gun mounted on his plane. I think it was an M16. We'll have to check with someone who knows guns for sure on that. On his airplane, and he would shoot the bear from his plane, which was about the only way the ranchers were able to survive. And then Field and Stream, I believe it was, got a hold of the fact that he was doing that and did a cover on their magazine of this defenseless bear standing with the plane pelting him, and the Sierra Club and some of those got so upset about what was happening on Kodiak Island to the bear, to the point that they had enough pressure to make that removed. And then Joe Zentner continued. He was a very good hunter. He got many, many bear every year. Ron Hurst had the ranch in Sultry Cove, where the bear came out of the refuge, and he got many bear, lots of bear. And even your bear protection people here now, when we had the problems here with the bear a year ago, they agreed with me that one of the reasons we have such increase in population is because Joe Zentner and Ron Hurst are no longer here getting the bear. Joe Zentner died in about 80 of cancer, and Ron Hurst sold out. Oh, goodness, I think Ron left the country in, I don't know, about 75 or something. So in these past years, and the sentiment has changed so much, Fish and Game would have a protection officer that would help the ranchers in getting the bear on the ranches, and now the public sentiment is to protect the bear. And so the ranching has all gone downhill a lot due to that sort of attitude. They picked up buffalo. We just had beef cattle. We had crossbreeds. We had brought Scotch Highland cattle in. We bought Scotch Highland cattle from Ron Hurst, who was running them in Sultry Cove, and we had Herefords and Galloways, horses. We even had sheep for a while. We had about 200 head of sheep for a while. Gotta think of a question. That takes us up to me being out of school for 2 years. And then I had worked on my master's in guidance and counseling. I graduated from Western State College in Colorado after I was married. I graduated in 62, just before going to Akutan teaching. And in summers, we've gone back 2 summers, I had worked on my master's degree in guidance and counseling. And the school district in 68, Marshall Lind was the new superintendent and brought in several new innovative ideas, one of which was to add an elementary counselor. And so I interviewed for that and became the first elementary counselor in the state. Oh. He used to boast of that. And I had 3 elementary schools. I had East Main and Peterson. So I did that, I think I, actually about 8 years, I have to go to my resume to see on that. But I was then divorced in 77, and then was remarried to Dale Rise, who had 2 children, Alex that was, I think Alex was about 3 or 4, maybe it was 4 at that time we got married. And Tabitha, that was about 2, though we never did have her live with us. And so I had my 2 and Alex, and our first summer ran the ranch. We went back to the ranch because Omar decided to go. We were still partners, business partners in the ranch. It was in a co-op, and he wasn't able to buy me out or dissolve the interest, so we remained as a co-op. And that was a fun summer. Of course, I had moved all my furniture out and everything, so it was kind of camping, but we spent that summer out there. And I had thought I couldn't have children, since I hadn't up to that point. And so I was real surprised to find that I was pregnant then. And so in September of 78, when I was 38 years old, I had my first child, Scott. And that was quite an experience. Dale was on the Storis at that time and spent 70 some days just before he was due on a tour to, I call it a cruise, from Kodiak to Hawaii to Japan, back to Kodiak, and arrived at finding wife a bloom. And so that year, I think I took leave completely. I did. I didn't work for the school that year. They hadn't replaced me at Peterson, so they contracted with me to come in and do some of the testing. Best pay I ever got. I got about $100 an hour. Doing that, because I could go in and do 2 tests in an hour, and then I'd come home to score them. And I'd leave Scott with someone on base, and just did that a little bit. But the next year I went back half-time, and then, I need to get my calendar up. Anyway, I went back full-time and worked at the school until we left to go to Oklahoma. Dale was transferred to the academy in Oklahoma City in 80, and we were there for 5 years. So, we're at Oklahoma.
Well, did it? Going back to the earthquake, how long did it take for them to rebuild the city? Was it a slow process?
Urban Renewal came in and did phases. And so the downtown area, of course, where the boats had gone right up through town, and the stores and things have been demolished. You've seen pictures of, uh-huh. of that area. Of course, they hit the low line and the most destroyed areas first. And then they were gone up from there.
Yes.
When Urban Renewal comes in, they lay out an overall plan. And they ended up, of course, having to redo areas of town that weren't affected by the tidal wave, which took out a lot of the older homes, a lot of the, there was an old Kodiak Hotel, that bear that stands down from the Harbor Master Building was up in front of the Kodiak Hotel. And it was kind of sad that they had to destroy a lot of the town. They just literally remake the whole town. And so those phases took probably 2 years before they got through on that. So it was a pretty ongoing thing. There was a school, the main the old main, let's see, what was it? It was a little red schoolhouse. No. The red schoolhouse of Sundays. Old main school. Yes. It was downtown. That, I don't remember exactly how that goes, but they moved. That school went into what is now East. That's right. Well, East Elementary was under construction right after that, and so that's where those. I don't know if they closed that school down. I don't think they did right after the Chatham move. I think they continued on with it, but it was within the urban renewal area. And so East Elementary then was the new school for that area. But it did result in a much nicer town than was here before. There was just zero planning to where streets went or anything before.
It sounds like it was like they explain about gold rushes, how the cities just pop up and the streets may not be straight, and it sounds like the way it was.
And so narrow. I remember when I was here the first time in 60, waiting for Omar to come in from the Aleutian chain, and a friend of ours flew, an older man, flew down from Anchorage, and we were.
Omar was coming in from the...
Oh, yeah. And there were sailors all over downtown. There were a lot of bars and all. And it was just, and Mr. Anderson, I just felt so safe as long as we would only leave the hotel long enough to go eat and then go back and sit in the foyer waiting for him to get in from the chain. It was foggy and the planes weren't flying. And so we waited a couple days for him to get in. But I just suppose that's the way Kodiak always was. It wasn't until later I learned that there was a Navy ship in. And of course, it was a Navy base then. It had, and the guardhouse was clear in toward Denman's Curve. That's where you went on to the base. And all the barracks and everything, those old barracks were there where Fort Greeley, I think, is that what it was called?
I think so.
Was, and on base proper was pretty much the only base housing. There were barracks up on Aviation Hill and all then, but it just happened that there was a big Navy boat in. That's the reason there were so many sailors around. And I thought that was the way the town was all the time. Not so. You want just Alaskan things.
Did you hunt while you were up here? Did you yourself personally hunt for deer or for bear?
No. It seems like on a ranch, I was so busy. And some ranchers do go into sports hunting, but to us it would have been for meat, and we already had our beef, so we never hunted for the sport of it. We had meat, deer. I remember Dave Gingrich that I mentioned previously gave us some deer one time. And the only other reason to carry a gun was if a bear was a predator.
Did you have any personal encounters with a bear?
We got one that had been that had made a kill over by the Wasatchuck River. Let's see what year this would have been. It was about 75, I think. About in there, It was the 5th of July, I remember specifically. We had discovered a double kill, a brand new calf and its mother were both killed over between Lake Rose Teed and the fishing area on the river down in there. And the bear had not eaten on the animals at all, so we were pretty sure that it had happened early in the morning. And the bear had not had a chance to feed before it got being frightened away. So we went and sat, my ex-husband Omar, and I sat in our Toyota Corolla about 10 feet from the kill, took a gun, and waited for the bear to come. And had rolled the windows down on both sides, made it out into a bed, and Omar suggested that I take first watch, and believe me, I would have watched all night. I would never have thought of going to sleep. So he was actually asleep for watching. So he had laid down to rest, and it was about 11 o'clock at night, and was getting that dusky look. And usually, frequently, bear will go up a hill. So I kept looking up. There's this real steep bank right across the road in front of us. I kept looking up the bank for the bear to ascend off of the hill, and then I realized that there was a road there, and probably a car had come along the road and frightened the bear, and it probably then had gone the other direction. So I looked the other direction, and there was this meadow on down in the direction of Lake Rose Teed, and there the bear came, just following the lowlands and through brush that was only about halfway up its back, but it must have felt protected being in that brush, and just coming closer and closer. And of course, we were between it and the kill, so it was coming right straight at us. And I got Homer up and out the window with the gun and everything, and he had, it was a 30-06 pump action. And he'd already pumped it, and so he was all ready to fire, and he waited until the bear came so close to us. They had real poor vision, and I'm sure it was just going on the scent of the kill. It came so close it was ready to turn and go around the car to the kill on the other side when he pulled the trigger and nothing happened. And so he did a quick pump of the pump action, and the bear then stops, stood still, looks right at us, and about died. And he pulled the trigger, and this time he did have a bullet in the chamber, and it fired. The bear turned just before he fired, so he was hit from a rear shot, and he dropped right on his rear end, was setting up on his front legs, just silent as can be. Omar jumped out of the car, barefooted, with the gun, went out, pumped again, and pulled the trigger, nothing happened. And I looked in the seat of the car, was the clip out of the gun. And so I grabbed it, I said, "Here, I think you need these." And I ran back to the car, and he put the clip in. It had not been fully engaged, I guess, and put that in and pumped the rest of the shells into the bear. And there's some of the bear stories I've heard about wounded bear. We were so fortunate. When we skinned the bear out, the first shot had gone in just to the about 4 inches to the right of the spine. I thought probably the way it went down like that, that it was a spine hit, but it was off to the side, and it had blown the liver all up. I don't know how long it could have stayed down. I don't know if it could have gotten up and been of danger or not. But what a deal. And we skinned it out, and the ranchers have to turn the hides over then to fish and game when they get them in protection of their property like that. So that's the only bear that I had seen, we would have many instances where we knew they were around, see tracks. We would doctor many an animal that had been attacked by bear. And my brother was cutting hay. I think he was on a tractor with a mower, and there was a leak in the radiator, so every little bit he'd have to go to the creek and get new water for the radiator. And he, on one of his trips, found where just the head of the fish was there and the rest had been eaten off just between his frequent trips. And I saw one on a tide flat at Woman's Bay one time, but we just didn't see them until we had the experience here in our yard last fall.
So when did you finally move here to those flats, when you came back then after being in Oklahoma?
No, when Dale and I were married, before we were married, when I was divorced, in the fall of 76, I bought this house that's down next door here. I bought that house. It was sitting behind Mac's Workshop. It was sitting where the back of Mac's Workshop now is. Was Egmar's furniture store, and had it moved out here, which was quite an undertaking for a single woman to do, and set that house up. And I had some help from the men at the church in getting that first part done, and Dale helped on that too from the church. And then, so I was living in there without electricity, without plumbing, the whole bit for several months down there. We didn't have any telephones at the flats then, and it was pretty rough in it. And I had met Dale at church, and he would come out. Most of our courtship was with him coming, and we'd cook dinner together for my kids and him and Alex. And then in March we were married. We went to Salt Lake and were married in the Mormon temple there. And he was on the base then, stationed on the base. But in order to stay then, he went onto the stores. So we did the tour on the stores. And we had this property was part of that adjoining property. And when we transferred to Oklahoma in 80, we sold 2 acres and that house and a couple of greenhouses that we had down there. So we had this property to come back to. And I had property while I was still half owner in the whole ranch, which was a 50,000 acre cattle ranch. We had homesteaded, which I failed to mention. We homesteaded our 160 acres out there. We did a 5-acre home site, which was another way to get land for a beach site at Calson Bay. We had to live there for 5 months to prove up on that. And so, and then we had done a 70-acre trade manufacturing site, feedlot, down toward Chinook. It's about a half mile past the Chinook post office. And so when I was in Oklahoma, I won't go into all the details on this, Omar finally bought me out. And I still held my half interest in the 70 acres out. We hadn't yet received patent to that, so we couldn't purchase that. And so we have been involved in an ongoing lawsuit against one of the native land claims, which you won't want to mention. So I then, in coming back, we had that as one of the reasons, this is for your information, that we were coming back because of that claim and that suit ongoing. And I had then 34 acres of Chinook that I have subdivided, and I need to get this other thing resolved. It should be by the first of the year. It's been about 15 years litigation.
Now, we just went to the museum and seen some of your artifacts today. Now, did that, how were the artifacts found? Did someone say, could we dig here, or were you people the first ones to find something?
That is on our 70-acre train manufacturing site I just mentioned. And when we were fencing that, my brother Lowell was working for us, and that was in about 72, I think I figured out. In digging the post holes, he found one of those beautiful big flimsy knives that she has in her showcase in that museum. He dug that out of the post hole, and we knew because of the midden and all that that you'd find the shells in the post holes. We knew that we had a site there. And then when KEA put power in out there, what, about 3 years ago, they cut through on my property line through and broke open a midden pile, and artifacts were spilling out and all. And of course, people who are into hunting for those sort of things right away, it's just like, how does a mag I find a dead rabbit on a road. They started potting is the term for people to come in and dig. But KEA alerted me that I had a site and a letter that went to all sorts of departments throughout the state, which kind of worried me because I was in the process of subdividing it, and I didn't know what sort of a hold that might put on my property, but as a property owner, it was just their way of alerting me. And so I had taken a class here. Hannah had put together a heritage conference about 5 years ago. And I attended that and became keenly interested. We had a lot of interest in archaeology and those things anyway. Traveled and visited all those sites clear across the country along the Mississippi River and all those neat places and mounds and everything. So I went to Rick and Philomena Kinnick, who had been instrumental in putting the Heritage Conference together, and asked them if they would come out and identify what our site was. So they went out with us one evening and were surprised. Most of your sites are along the ocean. And as we stopped completely away from the ocean and started hiking up hills, they thought we were out of our minds. And showed them this site. And immediately, with their trained eyes, there was a stump there that they just picked up about 10, 15 artifacts just off the ground that we had seen. Laid them on the stump, and she became immediately excited that they were Ocean Bay artifacts. She needed a dig. She was thinking of doing Kachemak, which is the middle culture, the Ocean Bay and Kachemak, and then Koniag cultures is the way they go. And she had a site located, Mary Jane Longridge had a site on at Port Lyons that she was going to dig on and use for her dissertation, but there were some problems arising. And so she needed a site and was really excited because Ocean Bay sites are real hard to find, and up until this time, all of the depth that they found in the Ocean Bay sites was 1 to 1.5 feet deep. And in that depth, you don't get any bone preservation. They just would find points. And so they did a test hole and expected to bottom out right away. And it went about 9 feet deep. It was just incredible. It was a mound. And they found bone preservation within about a yard, about a meter down. They were finding bone, and so they were finding things that had never been found. And the first, the carbon dating they got on it was 7,010 years before present, with about a couple hundred year margin there. So that's 6,000 years before present. That's before the pyramids were built in Egypt and the people on Kodiak. And so it did generate a great deal of interest in the archaeology circles. And there have been write-ups in the New York Times and so forth. She contacted some of her people that were, archaeologists have their areas of expertise. And so she contacted ones that had already dealt with this area, and so right away there were very key archaeologists here, Don Clark and Bill Laughlin, and everyone was extremely excited about it. And then Crossroads of the Continent, are you familiar with that? That started up while she was digging on the site, and she and Rick flew to the Smithsonian and talked with them as they were putting that together, and they were all really excited about the site. So she stands to become pretty well known over her findings with this site. It should give her enough material to work on for several years. The artifacts remain ours until we choose to do otherwise with them. There, I think some of the figures are like about 3,000 artifacts out of the site.
And will they continue to dig, or is there still more artifacts out there? It's just a matter of where.
Well, that whole area, I have to take you guys out and show you, but that whole area is site. And hard to say, it probably encompasses 5 acres, maybe, around there. And the one lot that I had subdivided and almost sold is where this is located. And we have done test holes on the adjoining lots of mine there, and they seem to be free of sight. But yes, there's lots more there. The first year they did the test hole, and then 4 squares joining that. Then the next year they enlarged the space just a little bit more, and then the third year they went on to adjoining property to see, you know, trying to get the edge of the site. And she had an agreement to dig for 3 years, and then she has to, it takes a lot of time to digest the findings of a dig, and so that's what she's doing, and the cataloging and drawing interpretations and her work and writing her dissertation. So this phase of it is complete, but we need to explore what are the possibilities. That could be inside.
Well, how did the natives treat you when you were a teacher down there?
An Akutan?
Okay.
I couldn't remember. They were really good because I was a shy new teacher, and I think I did quite well, though. I learned that one teacher somewhere before had let the teachers come to the school and sew one night a week. So I started a sewing night, Thursday night, I think. And they liked to come to the school to sew because we had a generator and the lights were good. And in the village, their lights were all run by a Peloton wheel, which is a water generator. They had a reservoir up above the village with large wooden pipes that kept reducing down and so the pressure would get greater. And in the winter time, actually it was pretty good because there was usually a lot of water. And to keep their lights were only as bright as the force of the water. And they usually had smaller light bulbs in their homes because they needed to run the refrigerators, and which they seldom, they didn't use refrigerators as refrigerators. They called them their freezers, but they were refrigerators. They just turned them all the way cold. I don't know if refrigerators were easier to get or why, but they all used their refrigerators like freezers, and they didn't need refrigerators. They just set things out on their porch. Something just cooled, or a pantry without heat or something with their refrigerator. They were very good too. If I was shy and wasn't sure how much I should intrude into their territory, but every Sunday morning, the young mothers, and young is like 16, they would get married and have babies very young, would come visit me at the school and show off their babies. And just at clockwork, about 10 o'clock every Sunday morning, here they'd come tripping up the boardwalk with their babies and sit and visit. And usually the conversation, even though I was shy, was pretty much one-sided. They just kind of sit, smile, and but there was an advisory school board, and Anisha was the president of the school board, advisory school board, and she was, I felt very at home with her right away, and we would go to their house, but we didn't really go to other houses. They had starring at Christmas time, which is a tradition that is with the Russian Orthodox Church. It's kind of a combination. I'm learning of their culture and combined with the Russian Orthodox. But they visit all of the houses in the village every night for several nights, and they bring a big they had a big glass star that must have been about 4 feet across, about a 20-point star, and it had the icons like the Saturday throughout, and very fancy decorated. And they would go into their homes and face it at, I know there's correct words for this, the holy corner in their house. You know, our Catholic homes often have, you know, like right in the corner, and there'd be little candle burning and icons. And they would face the candle that would stand on a stand. It had a back on it, and it would stand, and then they would twirl it, and it would twirl around while they sang in the Russian Orthodox song, which was really interesting. They have, music-wise, I'm not a real good one to say, but they seem to have more tones than we have in our music. It was and very dissonant sounding. And the men sang very strong and heavy. I remember good, strong male voices. And they would sing in each of the homes and then have refreshments in every home. And they invited us to go with them one of those nights. And we went to maybe only about five of the homes. And then told them dropped out. But they also have a custom called masking that I thought was part of the Russian Orthodox Church. I'd ask a lot of questions trying to sort out what was Aleut tradition and what was church. And even they didn't know. They didn't know how to separate it out. And it's only since that I've learned that some of the things I thought the masking was part of the church, just as the starring had been, and the masking follows, of course they have the Russian Orthodox calendar that's 2 weeks behind ours, but I think the masking was after New Year's, and for that, they would dress, and they would only let the adults take part in that, mm-hmm. and said it was a very serious thing, and everyone who took part had to be cleansed afterwards. And that, they dressed up in big stuffed costumes, usually, and masks. They probably anciently had used masks like we saw that at the museum. But they would go from house to house, and they had a record player, and they'd plug in and just put on music, and they would do a funny stomping dance, pairing up two of these, and it might be two women together, or a man and a woman, or whatever, and do this just stomping dance around. And they'd get real hot because they were all so bundled up, and then they would have refreshments again at each house. And of course, you could tell where they were when they went to the refreshments because they left their masks. But it was really kind of eerie. It was really
sad. What was it? Is it the celebration of?
And I asked the lay priest at the time what it was about, and he didn't speak English real well. And he couldn't answer my questions well about it. But I've since asked Father Krita here, and it is not Russian Orthodox. It is, it goes back to the their native culture thing. And yet they had it intertwined with their religion, because when I'd ask him why they did it, to them it was a religious sort of ceremony. And they said that to anyone who took part in it had to go to a stream, and they showed me the stream, this real swift little stream that came down behind the village, that everyone who took part in the masking had to go cleanse themselves from doing this, and they had to go on moonlit night to the stream and wash themselves somehow at the stream. And if they were cleansed, they would see the cross in the water, which is bringing Christianity into it. So, I mean, it was real confusing to sort out, you know, where, you know, what was truly Aleut and what may have been intermixed with Russian Orthodox, but it is not a Russian Orthodox practice. And I don't know if they do that around Kodiak or not. I know they star. Are you aware of the star?
I had a book at home that had the star in it. And it showed it, Christmas traditions. And it showed this star, and I thought it was the most beautiful star. And I thought, oh, that would be wonderful to make, but obviously beyond my capabilities.
There was one that museum this morning at the Russian Orthodox Museum.
Is that what was it? Like by the window?
There was one up, and it was all kind of crumpled on
yeah.
the glass. Yeah. But oh, the one at Acton was so pretty. It was, it must have had about 20 points on it, and I think every other point was long, you know, and then a short one in it. And behind the glass, it was framed in triangular shapes, you know, and then there were icons framed in all these, and then in the center there was a special frame that had a picture of a nativity scene.